Dr. Charlie Bamforth joins me this week to discuss the use of non-barley adjuncts in beer. This is Beersmith Podcast number 252.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 252, and it's late February 2022. Dr. Charlie Bamforth joins me this week to discuss the use of non-barley adjuncts in beer. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And I'm happy to say the web-based version of Beersmith is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. The new web version gives you access to tens of thousands of recipes, online recipe editing, advanced water tools, and much more. You can try Beersmith Web for 30 days by setting up an account at beersmithrecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version for one low price. Check out beersmithrecipes.com now to give Beersmith Web a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Dr. Charlie Bamforth, Professor Emeritus of Malting and Brewing Sciences at the University of California at Davis. Charlie specializes in the study of wholesomeness of beer, including beer perception, polyphenols, foam stability, oxidation, and flavor stability. Charlie, always a great pleasure to have you back on the show.
Yes, nice to be with you again. It's becoming a regular event, isn't it? Which is good.
It is. I think you're certainly one of the guests I've had on the most, I think. How's retired life treating you so far? You look good. You mentioned you've been walking 10,000 steps a day, I think.
Yeah, almost for the last 2 years, almost completely 2 years worth of 10,000 steps a day and occasional other exercise and watching my weight. But that's going back on again a bit. So.
I think you mentioned you've been able to stay busy even in retirement now.
Yeah, retirement's a relative term. I think I'm almost busier than ever. You know, I still am doing stuff with the what used to be called university extension, these days continuing in professional education at UC Davis. So doing a lot of courses. The classroom class is about to get going for this year, and we've been doing a lot online as well. And of course, I'm busy with Sierra Nevada as the senior quality advisor, and still writing books, including a soccer book in the last year.
You wrote a second soccer book, is that right?
Yeah, I helped a guy called Alan Hinton, who most recently was well known as the chief coach at the Seattle Sounders. I helped him with his autobiography. He and I go way back to England. He played for my team, Wolverhampton Wanderers, in England. In fact, the very first game I ever watched in 1962, Alan was playing left wing in that team. So it was a great honor to help him write his autobiography.
And of course, your first book, very famously, was on goalkeeping, if I recall.
Absolutely right. The goalkeepers of Wolverhampton Wanderers. So it was 24 guys I interviewed. That was a few years ago. But I'm still doing a lot of writing for a website called Wolves Heroes. And it's a great pleasure to catch up with all sorts of people and interview them. It's very different from beer, but I think they go hand in hand to talk about.
And I think last time we talked, you were working on some books related to beer as well.
Oh, yeah, there's an occasional beer book in the – yeah, so my successor at Davis, Glenn Fox, he and I have literally today sent in the second edition of a book that I did, the first edition, Scientific Principles of Baltic Brewing. But Glenn's had joined me in writing the second edition of that. And I'm going to soon, hopefully, finish the fourth edition of a book called A Beer, Tap into the Art and Science of Brewing. And there's one or two other projects in the pipeline as well. So, yeah, no rest for the wicked.
No rest, yeah. Well, today you wanted to talk about adjuncts, which are formally defined as basically any cereal other than barley malt. Why has this, before we dive into it, why has this become such an important topic in modern beer making?
Well, I think it's always been a pretty important topic. And of course, it's something that has attracted quite opposite degrees or opinions, very opposite opinion. There are those that are passionately against adjuncts. They say that, you know, you put an adjunct in there and that's just taking away all the wonderful malt. And at the other extreme, there are people who would even go so far as to say, hey, you know, who the heck needs malt? Let's just make an entirely adjunct-based beer. So I think people are intrigued. And one of the reasons probably is, of course, that so many brewers are doing all sorts of experiments with different product styles and different types of product, including non-beer products out of breweries. And, things like alternative sources of carbohydrate certainly lend themselves to the production of that type of beer. And, of course, you know, you can use the different selection of materials to introduce different qualities to beers, you know, whether it's haze, for example, or better foams. And so I think people are they're intrigued about ways to use them. To come up or broaden or extend a range of product opportunities. But still, you know, the Reinheitsgebot is alive and kicking in Germany. the ironic thing, Brad, is that, you know, people, they talk about the Reinheitsgebot, the purity law, and how wonderful that is. And how beers are, of course, the best if they're made according to the Reinheitsgebot. And yet, the reason they brought it in 1516 was to stop brewers using decidedly unpleasant materials, you know, like cow bile and things like that. So so the whole reason for developing the Reinheitsgebot was to stop people using very undesirable materials, not other materials that are, you know, sound to me quite palatable, you know, alternative cereals and so on. And the other argument I've often heard is that the Reinheitsgebot freed up certain things like rye and so on to be used in bread and other uses. So, but that's okay. But, you know, I'd sooner have the Reinheitsgebot than terribly horrible materials, you know, bits of animal that people have experimented with in years more recently. But, you know, think about it, you know, with according to the Reinheitsgebot, you would never get a Trappist ale. So that can't be good, can it? Because, no. You know, Trappist ales are some of my favorite brews, and there is an adjunct in there.
Just an interesting aside, but I had Greg Casey on in December on the podcast, and he was talking about American lagers. And, of course, you know, American adjunct lager, ironically, is the largest, is the most popular beer style in the world, arguably.
It is. And so many people say to me, oh, you know, they're using cheap old materials and so on. Well, they don't use things like rice and corn necessarily because they're cheaper. In fact, they're more complicated to use. They use them to give a lighter, more refreshing product. By replacing some of the malt, you're taking away some of the more harsh, astringent, grainy character that you get from the husk. And of course, you can get a lighter product in appearance terms. So that there's really good reasons for it. Good guy, Greg. Yeah. His son did his master's with.
Yeah, he was a great guest, and he also talked about, this was quite interesting to me, is right around the turn of century, 1900 or so, there was actually a big push to make a Reinheitsgebot type law here in the United States, and it was quite a battle, I guess, to fight it off and stop it, interestingly, and earn the right to have adjuncts in our beer. So
I mean, I think if people get away from the notion that the word adjunct is a dirty word, it's a swear word. They can get away from that and realize that as much as anything, it's not about cost. It can be sometimes about cost, but more often than not, it's more about opportunity and delivering alternative quality attributes.
And I mean, that was exactly my next question is obviously, you know, there can be a cost savings with certain adjuncts. However, in modern beer making, adjuncts are used for a whole bunch of different reasons. What are some of those reasons?
Well, there's a longstanding use been going on for years for malted barley based beers, putting a little bit of wheat in there because, as I think we may have talked about before, wheat, the proteins from wheat are tremendously useful as better foam stabilizing. The molecules of the protein molecules from the wheat are better than the ones from the barley. So there's a longstanding use for wheat for foam reasons. Then, of course, you know, there are brewers these days that are using certain alternative cereals in the production of hazy beers, using things, like rye and using oats, and things like that, which are kind of have a role to play in delivering the sort of the necessary appearance and the texture of beers like that. When I talked about the Trappist beer, of course, I'm talking there about certain types of sugar that are used to boost the sugar content in the boiling stage to allow the yeast to deliver those wonderful higher alcohol, increased alcohol levels for the Trappist style of product. And of course, in the world of gluten-free products and alternative products that no longer contain proteins that people are sensitive to, then there's a long-standing use of alternative cereals and pseudo cereals that can be used to deliver those sorts of products, and the list goes on. So, you know, I think if people realize that, yeah, you can use them to make gently flavored products, but gently flavored products are not bad beers. I may have told you this story before that back in the day at UC Davis, we have a brewing competition every year, and no student ever tried to design a Me Too Michelob Ultra. And the reason was it wasn't because they didn't want to specifically, but they realized that it's a hell of a difficult beer to brew. And all the sort of gently flavored, classically named North American lagers, if you make a mistake, you don't deliver that product every time, and if there's a defect, you'll spot it very readily in a product like that. So they're tremendously challenging beers to produce, particularly on the scale at which they're produced at, because you know any change in the water or anything like that, it's going to manifest itself very obviously. Whereas some products are rather more forgiving than that. So I like to say that the students would always make a IPA meets Hefeweizen meets Irish stout meets sour beer on the basis that if you say, well, that's a strange flavor, they say, oh, it's supposed to be that, you know. So they would be rather more forgiving products. So right the way from the gentlest flavored North American style light lager to the other extreme of fully flavored Trappist brews, adjuncts have a role to play.
Well, we often think of adding adjuncts and how they contribute starch, but virtually no enzymes. But in reality, the adjuncts do have their own flavor and can be a lot more subtle than that, can't they?
Yeah, they can. And so it's either that you're deliberately introducing some sort of characteristic, whether it's color or better foam or haze, but or indeed the other extreme, as I've described, sort of lowering and toning down flavors and colors. So they present opportunities to play tunes and deliver products of different type. But sure, you know, you don't look to enzymes themselves as adjuncts themselves as a source of enzymes. Although, you know, if you say you were using, I don't know, raw barley or certain types of malt, which again, which brings me to the sort of what is an adjunct is a malt coming from anything other than barley or perhaps wheat. Is it a malt or is it an adjunct? You know, is the roast barley that is used in Guinness, is that a specialty malt, even though it's not a malt?
It's or not is malted, it, right?
No, it's not malted, but yeah. But is it a special in the specialty category or is it an adjunct? So why would roasting the barley somehow make it take it away from the barley, which many people would say, well, that's very clearly an adjunct, and for some people, totally unacceptable. But roast barley, well, no, that's a wonderful thing. It gives all that wonderful character, including excellent foaming properties. So, you know, you very quickly get into the area of semantics. But when I was talking about enzymes, yeah, so some of the adjuncts will have some enzymes in them. By and large, there are certain adjuncts that if you use them in anything like a significant quantity, you're going to have to add extra enzymic activity, exogenous enzymes. And that, for some brewers, is a deal breaker. They you know, it's even more the use of added enzymes which upsets them more than the thought of using adjuncts. Mm.
Well, in the paper you sent me, you list corn as the most commonly used adjunct, at least in U.S. beer production. But what are some other common adjuncts that are used in beer?
Well, you name a cereal or a pseudo cereal, and also of course certain sugars. The list is extensive. So of course, in terms of cereals, the corn, the rice, which of course is most famously used historically by the Anheuser-Busch Corporation. Some brewers over the years have used raw barley, they've used raw wheat, oats, as I said, rye, the list goes on. Then, of course, we've got sorghums of this world. In the production of things like gluten-free beer, we helped a company design their product that was largely based on buckwheat, pseudo cereal. And then, of course, you got all the sugar spectra. So you got cane sugar, which is sucrose, and then you can split that in half to produce invert sugar. Some people use dextrose, otherwise known as glucose. Some brewers use high maltose syrup and other syrups derived from the enzymic breakdown of corn starch. So, you know, there's a huge list, and there's the whole cereal itself. You can, you know, use, say it would be raw barley, which would then, of course, need to be ground up, or other types of raw cereal. Then of course, likely the corn or the rice is going to come in the form of grits. Of course, the syrups are in a liquid form. They would be introduced into the kettle boil. Whereas, of course, the solid cereals would be introduced into the mash. And some of them will need milling, and some of them will not need milling. And, of course, there are the preheated cereals, the pre-gelatinized cereals, which, you know, are usually referred to as either torrefied cereals or flakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to talk about that. I guess most of the cereals that we work with need to be gelatinized first to hydrolyze the starches, right?
Well, there's a range of gelatinization temperatures. So, you know, malted barley, the starch gelatinizes in the sort of the low 60 degrees Celsius. You will recall I only ever use the C word. And so, you know, that is why the classic conversion temperature in a mash tun is in that area around
65
degrees Celsius. Now, wheat starch has got an even lower gelatinization temperature. So, you know, you can put the wheat into the mash alongside the malted barley. And rye and oats, they've all got starches with gelatinization temperatures in that range. But rice, corn, and sorghum are the classic examples of cereals that where the starch has got a much higher gelatinization temperature. So it basically you've got to go, well, essentially most brewers would essentially boil these adjuncts or take them to boiling in a cereal cooker in order to render the starch fully gelatinized, and then would transfer that boiled gelatinized adjunct starch to the main mash, which was mashed in at a fairly low temperature. And by mixing the two together, the heat from the cereal cooker is raising the temperature of the main mash away from the sort of the low temperature stand and raising it up to the temperature, the conversion temperature, at which now the barley starch is going to be, a malt starch is going to be gelatinized, and at which the malt-derived enzymes are going to break down the starch from the malt and also from the adjunct.
And I mean, most homebrewers buy the flaked or torrefied form that you mentioned earlier. But what is a, I mean, what does a cereal cooker look? Is that like a pressure cooker? I guess a lot of commercial brewers use cereal cookers, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't exactly describe it as a pressure cooker per se, but it's a vessel in which you can introduce your a slurry, basically, of say rice grits or corn grits, and you most probably will add a portion of malt in there, or if you're prepared to do it, use some of the added enzymes, some of the exogenous enzymes, and progressively you're going to raise the temperature, and there may be a stand in there to allow some of the enzymes that will convert some of the components at a lower temperature, but then you need to raise it essentially up to boiling point. To ensure that you've got good and comprehensive gelatinization of the cereal starch. But as you say, I mean, torrifying it, that is where, and that's how you make puffed cereals and that you have for breakfast. And they're passed under an intense heat source in temperatures in the range of 200 degrees Celsius plus, and basically they pop.
So I'm thinking sugar pops, right? Or something like that.
Exactly like that. That's what's happening. So you're developing some degree of color, but you're also gelatinizing that starch. It's swelling, and of course it swells and it breaks through the outer layers. And you change the texture as well, and the density of it gets much lighter. Flaking, that's a little bit different. The cereal is exposed to steam, and then it is basically rolled. And this is how you make cornflakes. If you want, and of course the flavor of cornflakes, they spray on some extract of malted barley as well. That they don't taste of malt, they of corn, they taste of pale malt, the cereal that is for the breakfast. But so if you are interested in making a lighter colored, lighter flavored, a Me Too classic North American lager, you don't need a cereal cooker. You can resort to the flakes. And of course, the flakes don't need milling. And the torrefied cereal, that will mill more easily than the tough old raw barley, for example. So, some people talk about the polysaccharides, the beta-glucans, and they say, well, the torrefication helps there. I'm not sure if it does or not. I had some data way back, my early days in the industry, where if anything, the beta glucan was more problematic after the torrefaction. But I have never, in my past, including my time with Bass, worried too much about the use of added beta glucanase. We were totally prepared to do that. So, in which case, if you are prepared to use the tools at your disposal to deal with adjuncts, for whatever reason you want to deal with them, then the preparedness to use exogenous enzymes is very helpful.
Well, you went through flaked and torrefied. What are some of the other forms you can get? I know there's, for example, liquid even.
Yeah, and in some ways, in many parts of the world, in terms of total adjunct usage, sugars, liquid sugars, is very extensive. And if I can take you back to to our days, my days at Bass Company in UK, which is now a hotel company, but not because of what we were doing. That was all to do with politics. But let's not go there. We used to use high maltose syrup. So as I think I might have said a little bit earlier, the way that's made is in a sugar factory, a corn starch is pre-gelatinized, basically, is gelatinized, cooked. And then it is broken down using defined enzymes to produce whatever sugar spectrum you want. So if you break it down in the sugar factory with a mixture of alpha amylase and beta amylase, then you're going to produce sugar spectrum, which is very much like that that you get with conventional mashing. So the number one sugar is maltose, and then you get lesser quantities of maltotriose, glucose, and about 20% dextrin. So the sugar spectrum is much like that you get conventional mashing of malt. So we didn't call it adjunct. We called it wort extender. Another way of
marketing
a word. And we used to put it into all of our brews in the kettle stage. Okay. So what it meant was, the reason we used the word extender was that it basically saves capacity, milling, mashing, lautering capacity. You simply put extra sugar of the same type of sugar into the kettle. Now, you can't go too high. We routine, it was about 20% of our total sugars, it basically, were in the form of high maltose syrup, because they don't give you any amino acids, so you can't just keep piling it in, otherwise you'll be limited for nitrogen. So we were about that, and we used high gravity brewing, which is another thing that for some brewers is a dirty word, and I think that's probably because they just don't understand it. So just to remind you, what you do is you ferment wort at a higher strength than the target alcohol content you want in your finished beer. So we use the high maltose syrup to conveniently increase that gravity. And so what you're doing in the fermenter is you're producing more alcohol than you want for that particular end product. And then you add deaerated water downstream to adjust to the final ABV. And people say, well, you're thinning out the beer, you're watering the beer. And the answer is, no, you're not. You're just essentially adding water later than earlier. And what you're doing is getting more beer out of every fermenter. And in terms of that alone, but also in terms of reduced cleaning costs and everything, there's a lot going for it. And the other thing it does is allows you a degree of flexibility. So you've got a stronger, a higher ABV beer coming out of your fermenter. Well, you can package that. That's your high ABV. And then depending on how much dilution water, let's not use the word dilution water, adjustment water you've got downstream, then you can produce a range of products of different ABVs. And if you're prepared to play tunes with bitterness and aroma, hop aroma with certain of these products that you can purchase, hop extracts and so on, and other types of extracts, then it's an amazing way to maximize your flexibility with high efficiency.
I was talking with a brewer recently who's doing the same thing with seltzers.
Yeah.
Because essentially you're just fermenting sugar, right? And they were, you know, they were going through some challenges because they're trying to ferment, you know, super high gravity, starting gravities on these things. But
yeah,
exactly the same reason. I mean, you can make a batch go, you know, probably 2-3 times as far in many cases, you know.
You can. I mean, as long as you've got everything in proportion, let's put it that way. So long as you've got the appropriate yeast count, you give the yeast all the oxygen it needs, as long as you're not limiting for nitrogen, as long as you may have to put in some zinc or something, or maybe some vitamins. But as long as you know what you're doing, and as long as you don't, for goodness sake, try to reuse the yeast if you go too high, then it's a logical thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, the brewing industry, Brad, is full of people's belief sets, and people say, well, I just would never do that. I would just never do that. Well, you know, I think you've got to have very good reasons for all that. And, you know, people say to me, well, it's just not right that people should use corn or rice. Well, why? I mean, it's just another form of starch. You know, but there's nothing, you know, I don't think God sort of decreed that the only decent starch is from barley and possibly wheat. I mean,
I would argue that probably beer was probably made from thousands of years with very little barley in it, you know?
Absolutely. I think the first, I mean, Walter Raleigh, the famous British mariner, he used to brew a beer in the Americas, and that was out of corn entirely. And you know? Also, yeah. people get emotional. They get emotional. And, you know, I come from England. Again, let's not talk too much about politics, but way back in the, I think it was in the 19th century, there was the Free Mash Tun Act, which was not that things were free. It was freeing up the opportunity for the brewer to use alternatives to malt for whatever reason they be. And there's all sorts of examples of that. And I know in the Second World War, there was a brewery in England that basically used potatoes.
There was widespread. Yeah, I've had several historical brewers on. There's widespread use of all kinds of adjuncts during the First and Second World War because they had shortages. And they had to make beer out of something, right?
Yeah, and pea starch. more recent than, you know, years ago, I think it was Nigeria, where there was a ban on the import of malt. And so people were obliged to use alternative things. And, of course, in the last 10, 20 years in Japan, extensive use of adjuncts. Because of the tax laws, there's a product style in Japan called Happoshu, and I forget what the exact proportion of malt, maximum proportion of malt has to be, but it's a fairly low proportion of malt, and if you're below that, the taxation rate is much less, so you're paying much less taxation. I think, again, it's to preserve the currency and not have lots of imports. So if you're there, lots of adjuncts are used, lots of rice, and sugars, and corns to produce these products. And then there's a third category, which basically says if you have no malt whatsoever, the taxation is even lower. Now these products, they can't call them beer, but they're packaged like beer. They look like beer. If you pour them out and look at them and taste them, you say, well, this is a beer. Now that, you know, I still personally prefer the sort of the classic, the you know, the Kirin Ichiban or the Asahi Super Dry, but these products are on that shelf, those supermarket shelves, right alongside the regular beers, and they're much cheaper. So what are people going to buy? You know, and that's what adjuncts can do. They give you those alternative choices.
Well, I wanted to dive a little bit into some of the adjuncts that are commonly used by homebrewers. I thought maybe we start with wheat. So can you talk about, for example, the difference between malted wheat that we might have in a German, you know, Hefeweizen or something like that, and unmalted wheat that's used in something like a Belgian wit beer?
Yeah, this is not an area that I've ever experimented on. Obviously, when you're malting wheat is more of a challenge than malting barley because the lack of that husk, and therefore everything's a little bit more sticky and less easy to handle. But of course, one of the big differences between wheat and barley is that cell walls in wheat are primarily something we call arabinoxylan or pentosan, whereas the cell walls in barley are primarily beta-glucan with much less arabinoxylan. Mm-hmm. So that arabinoxylan in raw wheat is going to be at its highest level. The good news, it's a good source of fiber. The bad news is that it's a non-starchy polysaccharide, which slows things down somewhat. So when you solid-liquid separation. So when you are when you've malted the grain, you are going to be producing more of the enzymes that are going to break these things down. And therefore, you know, the wort separation is likely to be more accommodating with the malted cereal than the non-malted cereal. The other thing is this, and certainly this applies for barley as well, that in the cell walls attached to arabinoxylans, there is ferulic acid, which is it's an antioxidant, but it is attached to the cell wall. And when you malt cereal, you produce an enzyme which is called ferulic acid esterase. And what this enzyme does is it snips off the ferulic acid and brings it into solution. And this happens at low temperatures in mashing. So if you don't have, you have the raw cereal, you're not going to have this enzyme. So the ferulic acid is not going to get into the wort. If you have the malted cereal, providing you mash at a low enough temperature, because this enzyme doesn't like heat, now you are going to extract ferulic acid into the wort. And if you have a yeast, such as the heifer yeast, the one that's used for hefeweizen, then it has another enzyme. This is called ferulic acid decarboxylase. And what it does is to take that ferulic acid and take away the carbon dioxide and make 4-vinyl guaiacol, which gives the sort of the clovey flavor in a hefeweizen. So if you try to make a hefeweizen with raw barley, you're going to have a problem. Whereas, of course, there is none of that clovey character you're going to get in the beers that are essentially derived from raw wheat.
Interesting. So that's, we talk about the banana clove flavor. I guess you're telling me the clove flavor primarily comes from the wheat itself, right?
Or the barley. I mean, barley itself has got, the cell walls have got ferulic acid in them. So, but although there is less arabinoxylan in the barley cell wall, there isn't the wheat cell wall, there's still a lot there, and plenty of ferulic acid. We have done a lot of work in this area over the years.
Well, some other common homebrewing adjuncts include oats and rye. What's the impact of these adjuncts on a finished beer?
Yeah, well, both of them, both the oats and the rye, like barley, are pretty rich in beta-glucan. There are some people, I'm not sure I necessarily am in that school, but there are some people who feel that this is good for the body of the beer, that the beta-glucan is contributing to the mouthfeel. Certainly when it comes to oats and oatmeal, for example, then it does provide a sort of dry character to a product. So something like an oatmeal stout has got a significant dry character. Not sure I fully understand the chemistry of that, but it's an observation that I think is well established. But of course these materials too, they do provide molecules that are likely to if you want to make a bright beer, a haze stable beer, low haze beer, and one that doesn't throw a haze, you probably wouldn't be too much of a fan of using things like oats and rye. But if you are interested in making a hazy beer, then these are the sorts of materials that you might like to look at for boosting your potential level of haze. But also there is a strong school of thought for some people that they also contribute to the texture, should we say, this type of product.
And what about more rare adjuncts like sour gum or some of the things used to make gluten-free beers?
Yeah, as I say, you know, there's a long history of using sorghum in particularly in Africa, but also in South America. And the sorghum is either used in an unmalted form or it is malted. That's quite a challenge to do that. But sorghum is, you know, it's been widely used, not only in those locations, but also in North America, for example, to make true gluten-free beers. Because if you make a beer from anything that, like malted barley or wheat. Even though you can do things like use certain enzymes to greatly lower the level of the gluten-type materials, because you've made them from barley or wheat, you just can't call them gluten-free. You can put in words like processed to lower gluten or whatever the words are, but you can't call them gluten-free. Whereas sorghum, genuinely, is something which can be used to make a gluten-free beer. I helped somebody at UC Davis. We did all the trial brews to help somebody make a beer based on buckwheat, and I think millet was in the recipe as well. We also helped somebody else to do it the way I personally prefer, which is using the added enzyme, which is prolyl endoproteinase. One of the brand names is Brewer's Clarex. Mm-hmm. And then what you can do is use regular malt, your regular malt brew.
Yeah, I think at the homebrew level, it's called Clarity Firm. White Labs makes it, right?
Yeah. I do. But this goes into the fermenter, and of course, will chew up the problematic peptides. And in that way, you see, you can make a product which has got flavor characteristics that you would recognize as coming from a malt-based product. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the best beer in the world, if you make a beer, say, out of 100% sorghum, bear in mind you also have to have that cereal cooker to do it.
Yeah. And so I think you have to add enzymes as well.
Oh, right? You most certainly would have to add enzymes. But you're going to have a flavor. You're going to have product characteristics, which are different to those from malt-based beers or wheat-based beers. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. You know, it's entirely possible to do that. And, you know, there's a brand called Redbridge, which I can remember came out of Anheuser-Busch, sorghum-based product. Perfectly okay. But a flavor which was not the same that you might be used to if you're looking for beers produced from malted barley. Mm. But you know, there's nobody say that that's better or worse. It's just different. And you know, it is what it is. And you've got to decide. So that the people we help make the beer from buckwheat said, no, I genuinely want to make something that is obviously unequivocally gluten-free. I want to call it gluten-free. I want to base it on that. So let's see what we can do to make as good a product as we can on that basis. And we did. And we did. And I'll tell you what the brand name is. Buck Wild is the name of that beer. Again, it gives you the opportunity, if you stray away from, you know, the Reinheitsgebot, it gives you opportunity to do different things and satisfy different markets.
And I mean, related to that, I had Gordon Strong on a few months back, and he went to Ecuador recently where he sampled some chicha beer. And he had one chicha beer that was so good, it was actually best of show. But I mean, in its purest form, this beer is only made really from corn and local flowers and herbs. There's no hops in it even.
Well, that's right.
So I kind of wanted to get your opinion on that kind of an approach.
Yeah. Of course, whenever I, you know, people use the word chicha, people talk about the traditional way in which it was produced. And that was by women. It had to be women. Apparently the men were no good at doing it for whatever reason. And women sitting around a bucket chewing the corn and mixing it with the salivary alpha amylase and then spitting into a bucket. Not sure that's how it's done these days, on a commercial scale at least. I do remember Patrick McGovern and one or two others, who remain nameless, sort of sitting around and doing this. Not a particularly digestible thing to do. But, you know, that and those, the traditional sorghum-based beers, and, you know, they're probably some of the oldest recipes and products on this earth. You know, some of the what's the best word I should use, but the native beers from different parts of the world, native to the culture of different societies, using local raw materials, and basically making products that usually were fairly low in alcohol, but making products using very traditional techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And basically some of the very earliest and longest lasting alcoholic beverages. And there's a tremendous charm. I've had in Africa beers, some of the traditional African sorghum beers, and they're not to my palate, but many people love them, and they're fairly low in alcohol and relatively low cost, and freely available, and that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I'm a great believer in I like tradition. I like the idea of tradition. And you know, remembering there's a proud history of all sorts of products, and you don't have to go wacky. You know, you don't have to go to extremes just to try to create something that nobody's ever heard of before. There is a lot to be said for more traditional approaches.
Well, we're winding down here, but I wanted to get your thoughts on using a large percentage of adjuncts and other risks, you know, running into enzyme shortages or other conversion issues when you start to push the percent of of adjuncts very high.
Yeah, well, that leads us directly onto the topic of barley brewing, as it's been known over the years. And it gets resurrected every few years for different reasons. I can well remember when I first joined the industry that there were brewers that were practicing barley brewing. In other words, 100% raw barley. A name that comes to mind was Tooheys in New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
But they went away from it. Most recently, the technology was really promoted again. This is in the last 10 years by a very prominent enzyme company, and basically they were promoting it on. Well, obviously they were promoting it to sell their products, but they were the slogan basically was, you know, in the malting process is very intensive. Use a lot of water. You're producing a lot of effluent. You're using a lot of energy. And why would you do that when you can simply use commercial enzymes to digest the raw grain?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, you can't argue against the logic of this. My old boss at BRF International, Brewing Research Foundation International, sadly died just a few months ago, Bernard Atkinson. He was a chemical engineer. And chemical engineers, they get very frustrated when you describe the brewing process, the malting and brewing processes to them. You know, putting all this water in and then driving it all off again, and mm-hmm. all this mm-hmm. storage, and then grinding it up, and then mixing it with water, and
cleaning
it, and soil liquid separation, and boiling and cooling. And they just don't get it. And why would you do that? So, out of that sort of mentality, people say, you know, why go through the malting process, for example? Why would you do that? Why not just use commercial enzymes and raw grain? And it doesn't even have to be barley. It's whatever's the cheapest thing available. And the answer is flavor, primarily.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are other things. But if you think you could make a Budweiser or a Sierra Nevada Pale Ale or a, you name it, you think you can say, well, we're not going to use malt. And in the case of Bud, rice, we're just going to use raw grain and enzyme. You're not going to do it. So it's entirely possible. I think there's a one or two breweries on the planet still that are embracing barley brewing. The time to do it is if you're setting up a new business. So if somebody was to say, I want to start a brewery, but I really I'm not a fan of You know, I really want to preserve the environment. I want to do as much as possible. So what is the most efficient way of doing that in terms of carbon footprint or water utilization, et cetera, et cetera? And you'd sensibly embrace the concepts like barley brewing, the use of enzymes, and you'd establish your product portfolio on that basis. And it's up to if you can successfully sell them to people in competition with beers made in, you know, more traditional ways, well, okay, that's the business you're in. I personally am not a fan. I'm not sure if I've ever told you this before, but, you know, after many years of Bernard Atkinson telling me that it, you know, the whole process was stupid, I actually got one of my students at UC Davis to basically make a beer out of Smirnoff vodka, and they basically just flavored it up, made it, colored it up, put some bubbles on it, and it looked like a beer. And we presented it to people and said, "What do you think?" And they didn't like it much. But when we told them how we'd done it, that didn't bother them. It was, what did it taste like?
Yeah,
you know. And Brad, you talked earlier on about, you know, the sort of the flavored alcoholic beverages and so on, and of course, many of them are made by making a very bland, gently flavored product and a beer and decolorizing it and adding the flavor. Well, why the hell would you do that if you just had an alcohol solution and mix it together with some flavors? And the answer is taxation. That if you make if you have something which is overtly a spirit, then it's likely to attract a much higher taxation than would a beer.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of breweries are going to seltzer because it attracts a slightly different clientele than the beer clientele, and they don't have to have a wine license or a liquor license or any of these other licenses to do it, you know.
Correct, yeah. Correct. So, you know, that again, it's just like the hoposhoes of this world. It's an exercise in broadening the product portfolio, but at the same time, minimizing expenditure.
Yeah.
So I think at the end of the day, my straightforward answer is I'm perfectly happy to use commercial enzymes in brewing operations, although I am associated with a company that won't do that, and that's fine too. I totally respect that. But I'm not a fan of using those enzymes if it's an exercise in going away from delivering beer in the way that I personally believe is best for product quality.
Well, Charlie, I want to get your closing thoughts on adjuncts in just a couple minutes here.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. As I've said, I think adjuncts can present plenty of opportunity and lots of things that they can deliver. They can deliver aspects of quality. And I've given you examples of that, which enhance what is possible. They allow for the production of certain types of beer that I love. You know, the candy sugar going into Trappist brews, I just think is an absolutely marvelous thing. I love my bubbles, and therefore wheat is a wonderful thing. I'm not a fan of using them to radically change the brewing process. I'm a great believer in beer being the way it is because of the way it's made and not despite it. So my basic premise is if an adjunct allows you to do something responsibly, which you can't do in any other way, then go for it. And that, in my opinion, would include the production of the classic style of North American lager. I have no difficulty with that product style whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And if it's a toss-up between using corn balanced against putting Rocky Mountain oysters into beer, I'd opt for the corn every time.
Well, thank you, Charlie. Appreciate you coming on the show again today and talking to us about adjuncts.
My pleasure, Brad. It's always a pleasure.
And today, my guest was Dr. Charlie Bamforth, Professor Emeritus of Malting and Brewing Science at the University of California at Davis. Thanks again, Charlie.
Thanks a lot, Brad.
A big thank you to Dr. Charlie Bamforth for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. Finally, I'm happy to say that the web-based version of Beersmith is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. You can try Beersmith Web for 30 days by setting up an account at BeersmithRecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version for one low price. Check out BeersmithRecipes.com today to give it a try. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.